Okay, today we are going to get into the text of Ecclesiastes. We surveyed the book last week, and this week we'll start off with chapter 1, verse 1. The word Ecclesiastes means the preacher. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. We discussed last week the relationship of this book to Solomon, David's son, who was king in Jerusalem. The book may have been written by Solomon. It may be a compilation of Solomon's ideas written at some later time. He calls himself here the preacher. He's never named Solomon in this book. He's called the preacher. And in fact, the way that that term is used suggests that it's meant to be like a personal name. This book is by Mr. Preacher, or as the Hebrew calls him, Kohelet. He is one who speaks to the assembly of God's people, and so he's gathered together, figuratively speaking, all the people of God. He has something on his heart he wants to share with us. And right away, in verse 2, we see the theme of the entire book. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. And that's how he starts the book, and that's also going to be how he ends it, down in chapter 12, verse 8. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. All is vanity. Last time we saw that this word vanity, which occurs over and over throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, literally means wind or breath. What could be less substantial, more transient and temporary than the vapor that comes out of your mouth on a cold morning when you step out the door and you breathe, and there it is just for a moment, you see it, and then it's gone, just a puff of breath. What he's telling us here is that that's the way all of life is. In fact, that's what James says, isn't it? What is your life? It is but a vapor that appears for a moment and then vanishes away. James is saying the same thing that Kohelet, the preacher, is saying. Your life is nothing but a vapor, a breath. It's the same thing that Paul says in Romans chapter 8, verse 20. The whole creation is subject to vanity. This is not a piece of Old Testament pessimism. What we're learning here is the nature of our world, of our life. What sin has done to the world, we live in a fallen world and nothing around us is substantial. Everything is temporary. Everything is transient. Peter tells us that the day is coming when the earth and all the works that are in it are going to be burned up with fire. Everything is temporary. Everything is insubstantial. It's not just vanity. It is vanity of vanities. Now, you've seen that construction before. What's the very next book in the Bible after Ecclesiastes called? Song of Songs. The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Well, what does this mean? Song of Songs. Vanity of vanities. Or to give you another example, in Revelation 19:16, when the Lord Jesus comes riding out of heaven on a white horse, he has a name written, which is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And every Christmas time you hear it on the radio, and the Messiah, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. What does it mean? King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Song of Songs, Vanity of Vanities. Well, let's start with King of Kings. Get all the kings in the world together into one place, and then pick one and let him be the king over all the kings. He would be the kingiest king of any king that ever kinged. That would be the King of Kings, the most kingly of kings. Lord of Lords is the one who is Lord over all the lords in the entire world. King of Kings is the best king, the one who embodies what kingliness really is. Lord of Lords is the one who shows forth quintessential lordliness. Don't you like that word, quintessential? I really like that word. Quintessential lordliness, the very essence of being a lord. That's what the Lord of Lords is. What is the Song of Songs? Of all the songs that ever were sung or ever could be sung, Solomon's song is the songiest. It is the one that embodies what it is to be a song. Okay? Vanity of vanities. Of all the empty, insubstantial, temporary things that ever were, of all the things that were just like a puff of breath and had no more to them than that, that which Mr. Preacher is going to tell us about is the vainest of them all. The emptiest, the least substantial, the most temporary. And in fact, what is it that he's going to tell us is so insubstantial? Everything that we see around us. Everything under the sun. Everything in our daily lives. It is the utmost vanity, the very vainest, emptiest vanity. Now that's really a theme for the book. Verse 3 gets us into his argument, and verses 3 through 11 form a paragraph. In this paragraph, he sets forth a thesis, an idea, and then gives a proof of it for us. The thesis is stated as a question in verse 3. I'll read the entire paragraph through. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. Well, the question sets the theme for this paragraph. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Three words here command our attention. First of all, the notion of profit, then the notion of labor, and then this phrase, under the sun, which we shall see many, many times in the course of the book. The word for profit here only occurs in Ecclesiastes. But it's related to other Hebrew words that have the sense of more or better. And here it seems to describe the notion of an advantage. What advantage is it to a person? How does it make him better? How does it allow him to excel, to labor under the sun? Later on in this paragraph, we'll see three examples of advantages that people seek through their labor. And the preacher will show us that all three of these supposed advantages really vanish away. They're inachievable. You can never attain them. And so the question really is a statement. There isn't any advantage. You cannot gain the kinds of things that people seek to gain by your labor under the sun. Now, labor here also has to be carefully qualified. Mr. Preacher is not talking about a good solid day's work. There are Hebrew words that describe going out, working, perspiring a little bit, coming back home at the end of the day, resting. That's not the point here. This word for labor involves the idea of mental anguish as well as physical toil. To see an example of it, look in Genesis 41:51. Genesis 41:51, where Joseph is reporting on his life's history in Egypt. Remember the series of events that brought Joseph to Egypt. There was a lot of physical labor. He was a slave. But there was a lot of mental anguish, too, being betrayed by his brothers and sold by them into slavery, being torn away from his father and his mother. Remember, he was the closest son to his father and yet torn away from his father. falsely accused and thrown into jail for many years, there forgotten and left, as it were, to rot in an Egyptian jail. And now when Joseph has been advanced to a position of leadership in Egypt, he's married and he has children. In verse 51, Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. For God, said he, hath made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. Now the word toil there refers to all the things that Joseph has gone through, not just the physical labor, but also all the mental anguish that he suffered. And he said, now I have this wonderful baby boy, and that makes me forget all the troubles that I've been through. Troubles, that's a good rendering for this word. Labor. Troubles. So, Mr. Preacher is not just talking here about a good solid day's work. He is talking about the approach to work which involves mental anguish. It's one thing to go out at the beginning of the day and do your work and come home at the end of the day. It's another thing to be involved in work that causes you mental grief and puts a lot of mental stress on you that you worry about because you're in competition with the fellow at the next desk. And if you don't get the promotion, he will, and you'll be left behind, and he'll go on to be the chairman of the department. It's that kind of a thing that we're looking at here. What advantage is there? What profit? What benefit? How are you the better for engaging in this kind of anguished labor day after day after day? A kind of labor that we sometimes describe as killing yourself. As a third qualification here. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he labors? Literally, it's the same word, the verb form of the same word. The labor which he labors under the sun. This expression occurs 27 times in Ecclesiastes, and it's unique to Ecclesiastes in the Bible. It describes the sphere of man's work. That is, this present world. In fact, another expression is upon the earth, which occurs 7 times, and the phrase under heaven that occurs 3 times. They all point to the same thing. The notion that, well, as chapter 5, verse 2 says, God is in heaven, and thou upon earth. The preacher recognizes that there is a heaven and there is earth. God is up in heaven, and you are on the earth. And that makes a big difference. He's talking here about the labor, the anguished travail that men go through here on the earth. The phrase encompasses the whole of our present earthly existence. It's not limited to bad things. There are some good things here on the earth as well. Chapter 5, verse 18 says, behold that which I have seen that is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life. We can enjoy good from our labor under the sun. Chapter 9, verse 9 says the same thing. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun all the days of thy vanity. For that is thy portion in this life and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. We can labor under the sun, and there is joy, there is happiness in it if we look at it the right way. But still we're concerned with the scope of our present life here, with the present world that we move in. So his thesis is of no purpose for you to kill yourself in this present life. Anguish, toil will bring you no advantage. And why not? Let's read on. Verses 4, 5, 6, and 7 present to us 4 of the cycles of nature. Nature doesn't hold still. The world is not static. It's moving. It's moving in complicated ways. The preacher singles out 4 of these complicated ways for us in verses 4 through 7. The first, verse 4. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh. But the earth bideth forever. Look at the cycle of the generations. Now, sometimes we have a hard time seeing that unless we come visit the Fleming family, because they're always having things like hamsters and finches around, which let us see how one generation passes away and another generation cometh over and over and over. You know, people are really no different from finches and hamsters, except it takes us a little longer. We don't do it every 3 months or every 16 days. We take a few years, but there's this endless cycle of the generations. People are born, they grow to maturity, they have jobs, they have children, they get old, they pass away, their children grow to maturity, and here's a cycle, and it goes on and on and on, and the earth just stands there, the background is constant, and here are people going around and around and around and around. A constant cycle in the generations. Verse 5. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place, where he arose. The sun comes up and it goes down. And then it comes up and it goes down. In fact, the language here is very vivid. You know, here's the earth. I don't mean to say they thought it was flat. But it's the point is, you're standing right here. And the sun comes up. Okay. And the sun comes up and then it goes down. And now it's nighttime. But what happens to the sun during the nighttime? Well, the sun's got to get back over here again so it can rise again the next day. That's what it means when it says, hasteth to his place where he arose. The word hasteth literally means to pant. It's what happens when you go run real fast and you're panting. Here the sun comes up and it goes down and then it runs like mad to get back over here to be ready for the next day. So that the next day, it can come up again and go down again. And then it runs like mad to get over here. So that the next day, it can come up again and go down again. And it's all busy, busy, rush, 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 hurry, 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 going around and around and around, the same cycle over and over again. That's the sun. Just like the generations. One after another, a ceaseless drone of activity. Busy, busy, busy. That's not all. Verse 6. The wind goeth toward the south and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. Around and around and around and around in circles. Where does the wind come from? Where does it go to? Mr. Preacher knows it doesn't come from anywhere. It doesn't go to anywhere. It just goes around and around in circles. And the same with the rivers. All the rivers run into the sea. Yet the sea is not satisfied. The sea is not full. It never gets any deeper. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. It sounds as though he's describing the hydrological cycle. Actually, the last part of the verse is, probably should be rendered, unto the place where the rivers run, not from whence the rivers come. But rather, the rivers always go in the same channels. The word for river here is the word that in the American Midwest is called an arroyo. In Arabic, it's called a wadi. It's not so much the water in the river that we're looking at here as it is the river beds. Israel is crisscrossed by all these dry gulches. They only have water in them when it rains. They don't run continually. It's the place where the water runs when the rain comes down. And his point is that every time it rains, the water goes right to the same gully and goes tearing down the mountainside and ends up in the ocean. Always the same place. And yet, the ocean never gets any fuller. Never any more water than there was the day before. It's always the same level. Here are the cycles of nature. Now, he's trying to show us that man has no benefit from all his anguished labor in the sphere of his present life. That's the point he's trying to make. He's given us this evidence that nature is involved in a state of constant flux. Everything is changing, and yet everything is always the same. The sun is rising and the sun is going down. It never holds still, and yet that cycle itself is constant. The generations. Always new faces upon the earth, and yet that cycle of the generations is sort of a constant. The French have a proverb. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more it changes, the more it's the same. The idea is that everything is changing, and yet as it changes, that very fact of change is an inescapable constant in life. That continual system of change is the foundation for his claim that man has no profit, no advantage from his anguished toil. The next several verses, 8, 9, 10, and 11, hold up for us three things that people strive after. Three examples of what people would consider profit if they could gain it. Those of you who are in a university environment will find these particularly close to your hearts, because these are characteristic of the kind of an intellectual life that Mr. Preacher lived, and the kind of intellectual life that permeates Ann Arbor. Three things that we seek, we cannot attain. They would be profit if we could get them, but we cannot get them. The first, in verse 8, there is no possibility of comprehensive knowledge. No possibility of comprehensive knowledge. All things are full of labor. The entire creation is in a state of continual fatigue. It's all wearied, because it's always rushing, rushing, rushing. The generations, one after another. The wind going around and around in circles. The sun going around and around and around and around. The rivers rushing down their channels, only to rush down the channels again, and yet somehow they can't manage to fill the ocean up. Now, because of all this busyness, continual change, it doesn't hold still long enough for us to get a picture of it. We can't get our arms around it. It's always different, always moving. In particular, there are three ways that we cannot comprehend it. First of all, we cannot utter it. Second, we cannot see it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. And third, we cannot hear it. The ear is not satisfied with hearing. These three activities of man in many different cultures have been considered as comprehending the whole of human rational activity. I think of the stables of the emperor's horses in Japan, where as a talisman against evil spirits, over the door there's carved these three little monkeys. What are they? Speak no evil, hear no evil, see no evil. Well, that's what you have here. Man cannot utter it, the mouth, the eyes, the ears. You see, man's rational activity is completely frustrated in the face of the turmoil, the constant busyness and weariness that's going on in the world. You cannot describe it. Man cannot utter it. You cannot describe everything that's going on in the world. A couple weeks ago, the Flemings got their encyclopedia. And so we all were looking up all of our favorite things. But I'm sure by now they will tell you a few things they tried to find out in there that they weren't able to find out. As that is the most comprehensive collection of human knowledge ever put together in one set of books. It's a fantastic set of books. And yet, man cannot utter everything. There are aspects of this that you can't find there. You can't utter the whole thing. Man cannot see it all. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. You can never see so much that you can say, okay, I've seen the whole thing. You know, I have a real problem with this. Whenever I go to a museum, I want to see every exhibit. I want to go into every hall. I want to read every one of the little cards that's under the things in the museums. I can't even do that with the Natural History Museum at the University of Michigan. How much less can I do it with the entire world in this state of frenzied activity? The museum at least holds still. The animals are stuffed. You know, the monkey is hanging from a tree like this and never moves. Or the bird is caught in mid-flight with its wings out. And even there, I can't capture everything. How much less can I do it in the world full of busyness and activity and change? The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. The newsboy stands on the corner and he cries out, "Read all about it." That's a lie. You can never read all about it. Or to use Mr. Preacher's language, you can never hear all about it. There's always some aspect of it that you won't be able to hear about. Some aspect of it that you won't be able to understand. So there's no such thing as comprehensive knowledge. That would be a benefit. If by getting out into the world and working like mad and killing ourselves, we could come to a comprehensive understanding of the world, that would be a profit. That would be an advantage. But we can't. The world is always changing. We can never get a complete grasp of it. And so Mr. Preacher says, what profit has a man of all his painful labor that he labors under the sun? And yet people do strive for. The great drives in academia are for comprehensive knowledge. Einstein devoted the last years of his life in the search of a unified field theory, one theory which would gather together all the forces of nature. And people are still on that quest 30 years later. Acts 17:21 tells us about the men of Athens who spent their days in nothing other than to hear or see some new thing. They devoted their lives to trying to gather in every bit of information about the world around them. 2 Timothy chapter 3 describes those spiritually needy folk who are ever learning and yet never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Man seeks for comprehensive knowledge. He can never have it. It is not to be attained. No profit. The second profit would be what we used to experience in show and tell in school. If you could somehow come into school on show and tell day with something that nobody had ever seen before. Wow. Wouldn't that be special? You know, did anybody ever bring a rolling pin to show and tell? Nah. Everybody's mama had a rolling pin in the kitchen. Did anybody ever bring an old washed out t-shirt to show and tell? An old pair of sneakers? Nah. Everybody had sneakers. Everybody had t-shirts. What did you bring to show and tell? Well, my grandma went to Europe for the summer and she brought back some wooden shoes. Look, I bet you never saw wooden shoes before. Look at my wooden shoes. Or, my aunt went to Disneyland and she brought me back a hat with Mickey Mouse ears on it. Look at this. This is like the ones on TV, but I bet you never saw a real one before. Wasn't that the whole idea of show and tell? To be able to have something new, something different that nobody had ever seen before? Well, when people grow up, they're no different. They're still trying to find something new, something different. And Mr. Preacher says, hey, give up, folks. You're never going to succeed. Verse 9, the thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. The things that you can show now are the things that used to be, whether it's in the sphere of nature, that which is, or in the sphere of human activity, that which is done. What happens now is the same as what's been happening, and that's the same as what will happen. And there's nothing new. You may as well not have show and tell. Because anything you bring in to show and tell, somebody's going to be able to stand up and say, that's old hat. I knew that last week. My great uncle, he did that. There would be a profit if we could gain comprehensive knowledge of the world, but we can't because the world is always in flux. There would be profit if we could show something new, something different, but because of these cycles, because the world is made up of cycles, we can never present anything truly new. You know, even Murray Gell-Mann, in expounding the symmetries of subatomic particles, makes reference to ancient Buddhist philosophy to summarize the basic ideas, the conceptual structures that inform those patterns of symmetry. Calls it the Eightfold Way. Nothing new. Maybe you're talking about subatomic particles instead of the interactions of men and nations. But it's still the same basic ideas over and over again. And there's a third area of profit. There would be a profit here to labor for if we could do it, but we cannot. That's verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. There is no certain fame in the world. If you could labor and work hard and guarantee yourself immortality in the world of men, that would be something. But you cannot. Oh, but you say, I can think of lots of great men. George Washington. Abraham Lincoln. I can maybe even think of some great philosophers from Europe. People like Goethe. People like Pascal. Okay. You're remembering things within the last 500 years. Can you name me a great philosopher between the years 0 and 500? Maybe I should say 100 and 500 to eliminate the apostles. Name me one single great leader from that period. Babylonian Empire endured for hundreds of years. Can you name me a great person from the Babylonian Empire who was distinguished for wisdom or for science? There were a lot of them. They built fantastic observatories. They understood the heavens. They did all their arithmetic in base 6. They weren't tied down to counting on their fingers and toes. Fantastic culture. Can you name one great person from that culture? Three of you here are working on PhD dissertations. You know that the first task of a PhD candidate in writing a dissertation is to go make sure that nobody has done before what he is pretending to do. Sometimes that can be a pretty tricky thing. One of my professors at Dallas spent about 9 months doing that on a dissertation, only to find out that somebody had done it before. So he said, okay, drop that topic, I'll find another topic. He found another topic and went off on that for about 6 months until he discovered that someone else had written on that topic before, and eventually he dropped out of his PhD program. Couldn't hack it. That's the nightmare of every researcher. The agony of wondering if after I've put months and years into this, I'm going to discover that somebody else already did it. That which there is no remembrance of former things, you see. Things that have happened in the past, we forget about them. You have to really dig to find them. And similarly, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. There's no guarantee that anybody's going to remember you after you've done your great work and made your wonderful name. 1,000 years from now, if the world is still here, do you think anybody is going to remember what you did? Do you think it's going to make any difference to anyone? You're going to get washed away in the same cycle of endless change that characterizes the generations and the sun and the wind and the rivers. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? Can he hope to get comprehensive knowledge of the universe? He cannot. It's always changing. It won't hold still for him to get a good look at it. Can he hope to find something new to amaze those around him and impress them with his cleverness? He cannot. What is now is what has been. Verse 10, is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It hath been already of old time which was before us. No comprehensive knowledge, no novelties, no certain fame, no way to do anything that guarantees you a name among the generations to come. So that's the proof of this thesis. There is no profit. The painful labor under the sun, that is, you're not going to gain any of these kinds of advantages that people are seeking after. Now, at this point, I must pause and ask the question, well, why work? What's the point of working at all if it is so futile? Well, we must understand that Kohelet himself encourages us in our labor. Chapter 9 and verse 10. He is warning us here not to expect great returns from anguished, painful travail. He is not telling us not to work hard. Diligence is as much a part of his message as is the futility of killing yourself for unattainable goals. 9:10. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, whatever it is that you are occupied in, do it with thy might. Do it with strength. Do it with energy. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. This is your time to work now on this earth. That's why you're here. Labor then. Do your work. Don't kill yourself over it. Don't lose sleep wondering if you're going to become the most famous person in the world. You're not. Even if you do for 6 months, 1,000 years from now, nobody will know your first name. Or again, chapter 11, verse 6. In the morning, sow thy seed. Get up in the morning, go plant the seed. If you don't plant the seed, nothing's going to grow. In the evening, withhold not thy hand. Don't say, oh, I'm tired now, I think I'll go to sleep. I'm not going to go out and pick the last few grains from the harvest, or I'm not going to make sure the cows are comfortable in the barn. In the morning, sow your seed. In the evening, don't withhold your hand. Do what needs to be done, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper, either this or that, or whether they both shall be alike good. You can't tell which effort is going to succeed, so you better do them all. If you don't try, you'll never succeed. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. And this is right in line with the broader admonition in God's Word against the sluggard. For instance, Proverbs chapter 6, verse 6. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, who, having no guide, overseer, or ruler, no one to tell her how to do her work, no one to stand there and poke at her and say, keep going now, keep working, you're slacking off. Only with the instincts that God has placed within her, she provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that traveleth, and thy want as an armed man. Be diligent. Work hard. Get up early. Work. Don't quit early. Put in a full day's work. That's good. That's proper. But to worry over it, to fret over it, and be anguished in travail as Joseph went through all that mental suffering and slavery in Egypt, that's not your portion. Do your work. Work hard. The New Testament gives us two main motives for this. One is that whether we eat or drink or whatever we do, we're to do all to the glory of God. And the other is that we are to work to be able to provide for our own necessities and for those who are with us. We have to work to provide our needs, and we work to bring glory to God. There is no profit under the sun, you see. There is no advantage to our travail and our labor under the sun. No advantage to us. But there is glory to be won to God's account by the diligent lives of His people. And that's the message of this first paragraph of Ecclesiastes. Now that can stand for us as sort of a summary over the book. Verse 12 begins an extended section that really runs all the way through the end of chapter 3. And I'd like to introduce this section to you today because it summarizes a concept that we've seen before in the Bible, and I think it's worth highlighting it up here for us. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. Here we are again, under the sun, under heaven, on the earth. He is going to give us a comprehensive study of everything that happens under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. That which is wanting cannot be numbered. I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, And I gave my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit, for in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. These verses, verses 12 through 18, to return to the academic metaphor, are like a proposal for a dissertation. And then the dissertation follows in chapters 2 and 3. The proposal for a dissertation is a little paper that a student writes when he thinks he wants to go off and write a great big paper. And it says, here are the things I want to study. Here are the methods that I'm going to use in studying it. Here are some ideas I think I might prove when I get to the end of it. In fact, we talk about writing a thesis. Well, strictly speaking, the thesis is the point you're trying to prove. So you set forth your thesis and then you go try to prove it. It's the conclusion that you think you're going to reach at the end. Well, that's what these verses are. This is Solomon's little thesis proposal, his dissertation proposal. He's going to set out for us what he intends to study. Then, beginning in chapter 2 and going down through 223, he carries out his research in three areas. First of all, in chapter 2, verse 1, I said in mine heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. The first area that he studies is the area of pleasure. This is not just a theoretical study either. He conducts a detailed experimental investigation of pleasure. He does everything that he can possibly think of doing that would bring him pleasure. Then if you go down to verse 12, I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. So now he will investigate the sphere of wisdom. And finally we get down to verse 18. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. Now these are the three areas that he investigates. First of all, pleasure. Second, wisdom. And third, labor, but with a special emphasis on who am I going to leave this all to when I'm dead? A special emphasis then on the wealth that labor produces. You've seen these three things before. You saw them in the Garden of Eden when the serpent tempted Eve and she looked on the fruit. She saw that it was good for food. It was to be desired to make one wise. And it was pleasant to the eyes. It was something she wanted to possess. She wanted to own it. She wanted to be able to hang it in the corner of her kitchen and say, look, that's mine. I have it. You see the same three things in our Lord's temptation in the wilderness. When Satan tempted him to turn the stones into bread, when Satan offered to give him all the kingdoms of the world, and when Satan said, cast yourself off from the temple to put on a big display so that everybody will come rush to you. Satan didn't say they'd all come rush to him, but that was the intent of that temptation. This is not jumping off the top of the temple because skydiving is fun. It was to attract attention to himself. Just as being wise makes one renowned in one's society. In fact, these are the same three areas, and I think probably John is drawing from these examples when in 1 John chapter 2, verse 16, he tells us that all that is in the world, what's Kohelet writing about here? That which is on earth, that which is under the heaven, under the sun, same sphere. All that is under the sun, all that is in the world can be summarized in three topics. The first is the lust of the flesh, food, sexual gratification, comfort in daily life, the creature pleasures, the creature comforts, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the desire to have, the desire to possess, the issue of wealth, the issue of the kingdoms of the world.